Welcome once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I am your host, Jonathan. With me today is Harmony Haney, a former public school educator and a parent of two children, both of whom are now adults. Harmony has 20 years of experience as an educator, mentor, and facilitator, and has been engaged with entheogenic plant medicine traditions for over a decade. She has a master's degree in education and an interest in broadening the discussion around the uses of entheogens by families in modern Western cultures, and is currently seeking a doctoral program in entheogenic studies. Harmony is a blogger and researcher, and is the author of the upcoming book, Medicine Children, on this very topic, which is near and dear to the hearts of our listeners. She also has plans for one more book in the series entitled, From Stoned to Sacred, Connecting with Teens Through Ceremony. Welcome, Harmony. Thanks for sharing space with us today.
Thanks a lot, Jonathan. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your book, about the work that motivated you to write it, and what people can expect from it when it comes out.
Okay. That's a kind of a tall order, but I will do my best.
All right.
So, you know, starting with the background, I became a psychedelic user when I was in my 20s, going to Grateful Dead concerts. And I found that a lot of what I had been searching for, I found through that community and through using psychedelics. But I was still searching for healing. I had a lot of problems growing up. I had a lot of emotional problems and physical problems, and was always searching for a kind of a healing that I didn't feel I was receiving from the sort of looser container that you could expect to find at a Grateful Dead concert or, sure, you know, a party or something like that. So in my searching, it took me a really long time. I was in my 40s until I found a community that used the medicine ayahuasca. And I do want to get into terminology a little bit later. I call it a medicine. Some people call it a psychedelic or a psychoactive substance. Some people call it a drug. And I want to get clear on those terms in a little bit.
Sure.
But I found this community, and I found an amazing healing occur from the use of this medicine, so much so that I feel like it gave me a second chance at life. At the time that I discovered this medicine and that I received these healings, I was also parenting two younger children. And over the course of their lives growing up, I've been part of this medicine community and found that, you know, there's a lot of issues in our society when you use a psychoactive substance and you're a parent. There's just a lot of issues that come up around that. And so my goal in writing this book is to talk about these issues, to put a conversation, a sane, you know, not fear-based conversation on the table, and to hopefully inspire other parents to some of these values that you have on your psychedelic website podcast, like authentic, you know, being authentic and being truthful and you know, having these kinds of spiritual connections that we can share with our children and not be afraid of the prejudice and the discrimination that is out in our society around these substances. So the book itself is, I wouldn't call it a guidebook. It's more like a discussion around some of the issues that I see in play. The first chapter of the book is going to be called ... but you can't give them drugs.
Right.
And it's basically a discussion around the hypocrisy around the use of drugs, quote unquote, in our culture. Because while we're calling these psychoactive substances or entheogenic medicines, as I like to call them, while we're calling, some people will call them drugs, at the same time, we are the most highly medicated society with pharmaceutical drugs.
Yes, definitely.
And that's not even going into TV, screen addiction, sugar, alcohol, tobacco, you know, all these other things that people have addictions to.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just want to call out for sanity in these conversations and for an honest evaluation and, you know, hopefully add to the conversation, let's really look at these issues. Let's really be honest and try to get out of this fear and, you know, hyper-reactivity to drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Just as an example, I can give you this a little story. When my daughter was, I became introduced to ayahuasca when my daughter was 9.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually in the blog that I'm writing. I'm recording all of my research about this book in a blog, which can be viewed at www.medicinechildren.info.
Awesome.
Anybody wants to go and read any of my research, it's all there. Some personal stories. I'm going to be doing interviews with parents upcoming.
Cool.
And those will all be able to be read there. But my husband at the time was an instrument builder, and we knew the interpreter for this shaman that was coming into the area, who was also a musician. And so he arranged for this shaman to come to our house to look at an instrument that my husband had built. Well, this shaman from Peru met my young daughter, 9 years old, and he told me through the interpreter, anytime she wants to come to a ceremony, she's invited. And I was just, I was kind of like, I never really thought about that. You know, I didn't really know anything about the culture at the time. I realize now that in these communities in South America where that particular medicine comes from, it's totally open for children to come and drink medicine whenever they feel that they want to.
Mm-hmm.
It's never forced on them. It's never a pressure, but it's just part of their life. And it's been part of their life for thousands of years and with no ill effects, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this was still kind of a surprise coming to me as a Western person. I didn't at that time invite my daughter to a ceremony, but I later saw that this shaman saw something in my daughter that, you know, he saw the light in her and saw that the medicine would be good with her spirit. And after the healing that I received, I did actually have a picnic with my children a few days later, who were 9 and 13 at the time. And I told them about my experiences, you know, in language that I thought that they could understand. I really believe in the value of authentic expression and telling the truth, and you know some of these values that you were mentioning on your website. So I talked to them about my experience. I just basically put it into kid terms. You know, I took a medicine that comes from South America, and it helped me let go of some of the hurts that I've been carrying around inside my body.
That's good.
Simple. And I said, I'm going to be happier and a better mom to you guys from now on. And, you know, I told them how grateful I was that I could talk to them about it. And I also told them, when you guys get to be teenagers, you know, there's going to be coming times when you're around other kids and other youth that are going to be using substances that alter the consciousness, the way that they, you know, the way that you think, the way that you are in your body,
mm-hmm.
such as alcohol, marijuana, you know, these different things. And I said, if you ever want to have that experience in a really safe place with people who are elders, who've been holding this as a tradition in their culture for a long time, you would be invited to come to a ceremony with me.
Hmm.
I realize how revolutionary that sounds, and I understand too that when I explained that to a good friend of mine, actually, a few months after I had said that, she basically looked like she wanted to call the cops on me.
Wow.
She was shocked that I would talk to my children about drugs, her words,
mm-hmm.
that I would even consider, you know, or acknowledge that it was okay to tell them about that and tell them that there is a way to do it that was safe, you know, that could be good for them. But that's my point, is that that's my experience, and, you know, my life and my spirituality, my connection with God, my heart, my ability to experience joy, all these things have expanded and grown through my healing with this medicine.
I would agree with that 100%. Yeah.
I really feel that I wanted to bring my children up with the ability to have that experience in a safe and I don't know what the other word is, a really good safe container.
Yeah, that's the word I like to use too, container.
With elder, you know, with elders, with that it comes with a tradition. And you know, I'm not talking about going to a concert with my kids and dropping acid, you know.
Right.
Although, you know, maybe there's a way to do that where that's also good. You know, my take and my particular, the way that I'm accessing into this conversation is through, you know, entheogenic plant medicines that come with a spiritual or a tradition, that come with, from a culture that has a tradition with the medicine. So even though I have a good feeling about, for instance, psilocybin mushrooms, I'm not going to really be going into talking about that very much in the book, because I personally don't have experience of an entheogenic tradition that uses that medicine. Now, I know that there are traditions that use that medicine in Mexico, but I'm sticking with the ones that I have experience with.
Sure. Makes sense.
So just to clarify that.
You said before that you wanted to go into more depth about terminology and definitions. We use the term psychedelic to describe the podcast, but our guests will often prefer entheogen or simply medicine. And I'm finding that the community can be very passionate about terminology because of the cultural baggage that often comes with certain words. So tell me about your understanding regarding definitions and terminology.
I think that we're kind of confused in this culture about the term drug.
Yep.
and medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a little section in the book that talks about these terms. I also think that we have a hyper trigger in our culture. It's when we think about drugs as something that people take that they harm themselves.
Mm-hmm, sure.
or become addicted. You know, it's like a drug addict is like a terrible thing, you know. And so in my definition, a drug is something that people take to alleviate a symptom or to escape.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would cover, you know, using heroin or
sure.
It could even be, you know, over medicating with sugar.
Sure. Yeah.
It could be, you know, there's a lot of things that could be drugs, and there's a whole section in the book about addictions as well. A medicine, on the other hand, is something that you take that's a cure. That's something that actually can get to the root of the problem and make you better. And I'm a much better with writing than I am with speaking.
You think you're doing great.
Just to say, so it's explained a little bit better on the blog, you know, more thoroughly, I guess you
sure.
could say. But I think that it's a really important distinction, you know, this hysteria we have about, you know, just say no to drugs. You know, it makes me want to rip my hair out when I hear that and the war on drugs. And at the same time, you know, finding out through my research that, you know, they're prescribing antibiotics to kids that are under 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Antidepressants rather.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they're prescribing, you know, there's the drug, to me, that's drug abuse.
Yeah.
And somebody taking a naturally occurring plant that mm-hmm. grows on the earth to help better themselves, to help clear their emotional body or find a greater connection with the spirit, God, I just don't see that as drug abuse. I see
yeah.
that as a spiritual practice. And that's the way that it is for me, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that this, the last conversation that I had with my friend David Guyon, he was talking a little bit, he kind of hinted around the edges about this idea of terminology and what's the best language to use when discussing these things. When I originally started this podcast, you know, psychedelic parenting made the most sense to me. But I think that that's a word that also has carried some baggage.
Yeah.
However, when it was invented, when the word was coined by Humphrey Osmond, he was coining it as like an alternative to a word that had developed negative baggage, which was hallucinogen.
Yes.
So like, it's interesting how these words sort of like gain negative baggage over the years or whatever. And the thing that I just wrote a blog post for Vice for Motherboard. And one of the things that I hinted at in that was that this idea of the term hallucinogen, or I'm sorry, psychedelic, you know, when Humphrey Osmond coined it, he coined it to mean mind manifesting. But the word psyche which our one of our bloggers, Daphne Dawn, pointed out in a blog post, and I utilized this, was that the word psyche can also be translated to mean soul or spirit. So it can mean mind manifesting, but it can also mean this that which makes the soul visible. So I think that's pretty cool. And
That
that
is cool. Well, and that kind of goes back to the entheogen, the word
right.
entheogen, which means some ingesting the divine, theo, or taking the divine within. Or I define an entheogen as something, a substance that helps one connect with the divine. So there's a little bit of that. Yeah, there's a little bit of those kinds of terminologies. And I think that people have a little bit of a stereotype when it comes to the word psychedelic. I was that stereotype when I was in my 20s. I was like one of those kids at a dead show that was out dancing like crazy, And but I in my I have that a story about that actually in the blog. And what taking that substance when I was a younger person helped me to do was it was the very first time that I experienced freedom from my absolutely crippling self-doubt and my constant worry about what other people thought about me. I grew, you know, I there's some personal stuff in my blog about my childhood and my different, my problems that I've had. But this was, taking that medicine was an incredible jump towards freedom. At the same time, I feel that what I was really searching for in that community and onwards all through my life was this tradition of using a plant medicine for spiritual growth. Yeah, so there's a lot of history. I mean, there's so many books about entheogens and the history and the court cases and all of that stuff. I touch on that a little bit in the blog, but I don't really want to recreate the wheel in terms of just writing another book because it's already really well spelled out, What I'm really interested in is, for example, I hope that this book, I haven't gotten to this part in my blog, but I hope that I can get to the part in the blog and in the book where what I'm writing about is going to be able to help parents talk to, let's say really conservative family members, and have a way to access being authentic and talking about what their true beliefs are. If they're a person that uses an entheogenic substance and they have children, they're going to be faced with a lot of judgment and, negativity if they admit that. And they can, and it can actually even get to the criminal. It can get to where their parent, other co-parents, exes can take their children away
Yeah,
if
that
they're.
seems to be the one of the real sort of contentious places in this community is dealing with child custody and things.
It's huge. I mean, I have a whole section in the blog about I had an interview with a lawyer who is I'm keeping her anonymous for the very reason that if her ex knew that she had been to ayahuasca or yahe, as we call it from Colombia, if she, her ex knew that she had been involved in the yahe ceremonies, he would sue her for custody. And her contention is that even if there is one episode of a parent using a quote drug, something the way that it's currently defined in our culture, that almost certainly the courts would side with the other parent.
Yes, definitely. Although I think that is changing slowly, especially when it comes to the sort of field of, you like taking the position of religious freedom when it comes to these experiences. I think that is beginning to chisel away a bit at that. So that's where I see some hope in that.
Yeah, well, excuse me. There's definitely been movement. I mean, since the 90s, having, different churches like the Daime Church and the UVD Church have created legal churches here in the United States. There's another church that's also asked to be remain anonymous, but it's a church that involves the Yahe tradition that's become a legal church here in the United States. And so there is some movement towards that. There's also, I just think public opinion is starting to relax a little bit around these things. And, you know, more and more people have actually had exposure. I mean, this lawyer that I talked to is a perfect example. She was extremely prejudiced about psychedelics and psychoactive substances and was kind of in the opinion of like, I would never do that. And then for some reason, she had a kind of an opening or a softening. A friend of hers invited her to come to one of our ceremonies. And she came and had an amazingly powerful experience, and it completely changed her life. And yet she still has to be in the closet, and not just because of her parenting, but because of her being in the legal system.
Yeah.
She feels that if people knew that she did that, you know, she wouldn't, it would be a bad thing for her career.
Yeah. I've drank with, police officers, with doctors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that, you know, that opinions are slowly changing, and I think that what needs to happen is that there has to be, and I really like that you're saying that you want your book to be a tool for people to say, come out to their family members, because whenever I talk to people, I say, like, especially young people in their 20s that are really passionate about these experiences, that, you know, the way that you're going to change the wider culture is to go to your mom, to go to your aunt, to go to your grandma and say, do you see that I'm a better person than I used to be? Here's why.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that exact thing happened with me and my mom. She noticed over time how much happier, how my capacity to experience joy was increasing, how I was just managing. So I have a history of really bad depression and self abuse and different all kinds of things and everything. I was just getting better and better. And she didn't really ask me about it, but I told her at first. I told her I was part of a healing tradition from South America, but I didn't really go into the medicine. And finally, I invited. She read my blog, and she was like, "Oh, okay, that explains what you've been doing." Mm-hmm. You know.
Hmm. That's a really great story about your mom, and my own story with my own parents is not dissimilar. But let's circle back around to your children and the story you were telling about coming out to your kids about your medicine use, and maybe go a little bit deeper about their reaction or how they responded to your invitation to join.
I do have permission, by the way, to talk about this from them. My daughter's 20 and my son is 24. Mm-hmm. And, my daughter just turned 21 last week. Sorry. And so again, back to that experience when they were young or 9 and 13, I invited them to come to ceremony when they wanted to. My daughter actually took me up on that, right before her 13th birthday. She had never taken anything. She'd never smoked pot or drank alcohol or anything, at that point. And she said she wanted to come to a ceremony, and she personally knew in Colombia, we call them Taita, our teacher. She knew him. He came to our house and everything. And since then, she's been to many, many ceremonies over the course of her later teen years and, up until, she kind of has been taking a break for the last year or so. My son, on the other hand, has never been very interested in spiritual things, and the idea of kind of working on himself doesn't really see the need for that. He's kind of more of a mental computer guy, you know, and that's fine. And he actually came twice, both times asserting that it was for my benefit, not his. and he didn't, you know, he didn't have much of an, I think in a lot of ways you get out of it what you put into it. So he didn't really expect to get much out of it. And I don't know that he did. So I have, you know, kind of one of each, in terms of their experiences. But I was very supportive about that, especially when my daughter was younger. We would spend hours late after the experience processing, what happened and the different things and, talking about it together. And, it was a really valuable part of our relationship.
Awesome.
And we also, stayed even through the most, acting out and kind of ballistic teen years that she went through, we still maintained that connection and that closeness and that ability to communicate with each other, which in part I feel was really due to the medicine work that we've done, that I've done, helping me be a better parent, be more open, be less reactive, things like that. And then through that, maintaining that connection and, having that kind of spiritual commonality.
Yeah, so I'd like to ask you two questions evolving out of this conversation of your kids, because we did mention a little bit about containers. And so I guess first of all, I'd like to ask you, how do you think that, say, your daughter who has done a lot of this work, how do you think that she sort of would compare to her peers in terms of her growth and her maturity as a human being and stuff?
Well, I feel like she was already, I feel like before we even began this medicine path, she was way off the charts in terms of her spiritual. She just came in a really high level. I mean, people talk about indigo children and the
Sure.
distances and that, and I think that, I don't know what to make of all the labels and everything, but she was really a special person even to begin with. And I mentioned this in the blog, and I'm actually going to spend some time talking about this in the book. It's really complicated. I want to do this because I feel like in some ways, as a maybe I'm a pioneer or something with bringing my daughter into a ceremony like that. I mean, I know other parents do, but I wasn't aware of the stress that I might be putting on her. So what I mean by that is that she became part of a community of people, mostly adults, who were really very spiritual and working on themselves and, working on very high level integrity and honesty and communication with each other and, conscious communication and all these things. She's exposed to that world and spending time in that world and then going into the world of her high school
Oh,
where
yeah.
it was just this absolute contrast and, people are gossiping and being ill towards each other and lying and stabbing each other in the back and, and just being very small and, and it was really very challenging for her to be part of these two worlds, although I know that she appreciated knowing about, being part of a world where people were kinder and more, good to each other. But it was difficult. And the other difficulty was in the fact that, she felt like she had to hide at sometimes what was true in her life. She couldn't just talk about that with people, with anybody. She couldn't talk about the fact that she was part of a spiritual community because of worrying about, like, for instance, when I was a public school teacher when I became part of this medicine community, and I don't know what would have happened if that knowledge had come out into the school district, but I imagine, that it wouldn't have been looked upon favorably.
One can imagine that, yes.
And so it was difficult for her. However, and I made a joke about this in the blog, but I felt like she sort of became the Lucy, like the doctor is in Peanuts Lucy. She became like the Lucy to her friends, as she was just always a very grounded and happy, joyful, kind of presence in her group, and all the dramas that would go on, and people would be always coming and talking to her and help, and always finding a helpful listening ear. And she carried a lot of responsibility for, for being helpful to her friends like that going through high school and everything. And I think to this day she's in that, still in that kind of a role.
Right on. So let's talk about containers then. One of the things that I'm really interested in is how do we as white middle-class Americans build a quote-unquote indigenous tradition here, and meaning indigenous in the sense of like grounded in where we are right now as, you know, middle-class Americans. So what would you envision a medicine tradition in North America among middle-class people to look like, and how would it pass on those traditions to its children?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, the medicine doesn't discriminate between somebody from Colombia or Peru or the United States or middle class or poor. The medicine has an intelligence.
I agree.
And it will help the person where they need it. Mm-hmm. So it isn't, there isn't really, it's not like there has to be one way to do it for people from South America and one way to do it for people in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just, it, no matter who drinks that medicine, they're going to find help if that's what they're looking for. And, mm-hmm. you know, that, so just to say that much, uh-huh. but, you know, my strong feeling, and I'm not the voice of everyone on this, you know, this mm-hmm. is just my opinion. I believe that the container starts with the training. If somebody in my opinion, to make a safe container, the person that's holding the space for the ceremony, for the air, you know, the people who are coming there for help, they need to be trained. They need to be connected to a lineage and mm-hmm. have elders and have people who have been in doing this work for a long time. And that's just my really strong opinion. So even if it's people who are studying with elders and then, but who are white middle class people, as long as they're having that connection with that lineage, I feel like, you know, that's how the ceremonies and the container is going to transfer up here. You know, we're blessed and lucky that right now we have the ability to have elders from those traditions come up here
mm-hmm.
and help us up here. And there's also, of course, opportunities for people to go down to South America and have experiences down there in those communities.
Mm-hmm.
But I see a lot of people who go and drink medicine a couple times and then they think that they can go buy some or get some off the internet and make it and then just start serving it to all their friends. And to me, you know, I don't want to judge what they're doing. I would never choose to go do that with them in that situation because I wouldn't trust the container. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my caution, and this is something that I also have talked with my kids about, you know, if you want to do these medicines with other people, just really do your homework. You know, make sure that you really can put your trust into the people who are in charge of the ceremony.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I don't know if that answered your question. I mean, I think, did I?
That's a great answer. Mm-hmm. But what I'm really interested in is, how do you think that we should be ideally passing these traditions on to our kids?
I see. Well, it's funny because I have another book on the pipeline after I finish this one. And it's called From Stoned to Sacred: Connecting with Teens Through Ceremony.
Awesome.
And the idea of that book is to talk about, and this is such a controversial topic. I mean, I feel like if I even say it out loud, people are going to be like, what? But it's to talk about psychedelic mentoring and to talk about how do we elder our youth in these things that, you know, I mean, right now it's not legal for anyone to do, you know, these things, except yeah. for, I mean, if you're a member of a church, maybe it's a little more legal.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would like to see the day when, you know, there were systems in place where if a young person wanted to do an exploration with a medicine, that there is an elder or an elders or a way of access where they could have access to a safe container, you mm-hmm. know? And the reason I say that is because right now, you know, and the same thing was true when I was a kid, it's the blind leading the blind or the stoned leading the stoneder. You know? I mean, it's like kids are, they're going to go do these things anyway. A
Yes.
lot, not every kid, of course, but a lot of them will. And a lot of them are going to want to experiment. And so, you know, but what they do is they end up, you know, kind of coaching and counseling and keeping space for each other when they're not, when they, you know, they don't have the maturity and the clarity to really be doing that the best that could be done. You know, they make the best out of it, of course. And, you know, so did I when I was a kid, but
as did I, yes.
You know, I had some really hairy and scary experiences when I was younger because I wasn't in a safe place.
Right.
When I was altered, you know, when I was working with medicines, I was just all over the place. And, you know, I would like to see our culture evolve to the point where there were safe spaces, for kids to go to receive that. And, you know, where there wasn't such a danger of you know, having that just be, you know, at this point, I don't see that happening anytime soon because there's still such a prejudice. But I hope that we can keep shining the light on this subject and, you know, open people's minds up to the fact that these medicines can be helpful and useful.
Well, I think that there is reasons to be hopeful. I mean, just in terms of like the party scene, you know, we have groups like Dance Safe and the Zendo Project at MAPS who are, you know, creating safe spaces in party situations where people can actually experience some healing around these medicines, even if they didn't necessarily intend to do it that way.
Yeah.
So I think that there are, you know, I think that there is hope. And you know, I think too that just because the sort of cultural landscape around, especially like cannabis, is changing, and I feel like the world of plant medicines is kind of being drawn up into the conversation because of the way that we're talking about cannabis now. And so, you know, I have a lot of hope, and I think that, you know, in the next generation, we're going to be doing things. We already are. You know, you're doing things differently. I'm doing things differently. Many of the people that I talk to are doing things differently. And I think that there's a lot of reasons to be hopeful about the next generation for this work in North America.
Yeah, good. Well, I like being hopeful. I like being positive, and you know, that's why I want to put this book out in the world, is just to be part of the conversation of change.
Right on.
Now, you know, we all have things that happen when we're kids that wound us, and a lot of us end up carrying them for our whole lives.
Yeah. It's amazing how these ideas of, like, you know, wounds in early childhood, when we think that we're not even terribly conscious, affect us in our later lives. And, you know, I think even as you were talking about that, I was thinking about like fairy tales and how so many of them are based in, like, you know, losing a parent when someone is young and how that sort of reverberates in their life. Recently I interviewed Catherine McLean, who used to work for Johns Hopkins, and she was talking about how even people that she would sit with in these studies who were otherwise healthy people would, you know, these really deep wounds from very young ages would sort of surface during these experiences, and people had this opportunity to, like, transform those things and become conscious of them and heal them. And, you know, Stan Grof's work with breathing, it's all about, like, healing sort of the wounds of childhood and infancy. It's really interesting how that stuff sticks with us even when we don't consciously remember it.
Well, I that's very true. And one of my personal stories, when I first went to Colombia, I met a medicine man down there who was working with me, with this chronic back and hip pain that I've had my whole life. And he was working on me, and he had to go through an interpreter, but he basically told me that the energy that I was carrying in my pelvis and my hips was from my childhood, that if I didn't do something about it, that it was going to become probably a fatal disease, like not even that far into the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that I needed to do this journaling and kind of stuff about my childhood so that I could access the wound that was being stored in my body, you know. And I was just like, whoa, oh my gosh, I don't have a fatal disease, you know? So, you know, luckily, again, the medicine has been helping me, you know, continuing to help me, you know, go through these issues and to uncover the roots, not just treat the symptoms, you know, which is what I feel, you know, I mentioned several times in the blog that, you know, we live in this take a pill to cure every ill kind of a society.
Right. Yes.
Anytime we have a little bit of pain or discomfort or this or that, you know, I was at my mom's place in New Jersey last winter visiting her, and I don't normally watch TV, but we were there together watching TV, and in 1 hour I saw 12 prescription drug commercials mm-hmm. on the television, you know. Mm-hmm.
So it's funny that you should mention television. Terrence McKenna used to say that television was the great addiction of American culture, and I personally also think of it as such in many ways. Before we started this conversation, you mentioned that you wanted to talk about addiction and how it relates to the taboo of psychedelics in our culture. So why don't you tell us your feelings on that?
I talk a lot in the book about how we live in a society of addicts. And yeah. So there's a lot of reasons why addiction is such an incredible problem these days. And it's not just being addicted to the normal things that you might think of, like cigarettes or alcohol or coffee or anything. You know, it's screen time, it's internet porn, it's, you know, sugar and all these, there's all kinds of, I mean, you can be addicted to shopping, you can be, you know, all kinds of things that people are addicted to. And mm-hmm. And the incidence, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, the addiction recovery industry in this country, kind of hand in hand with the prescription drug industry. When I start looking at these issues, I have found that, you know, if I also want to mention about the Title I or the Schedule I controlled substance mm-hmm. designation for a lot of these substances, such as, you know, peyote, psilocybin mushrooms, DMT. Mm-hmm. If people don't know what Schedule I means, you know, it means drugs with no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. The most dangerous drugs of all the drug schedules with potentially severe psychological or physical dependence. Mm-hmm. So, We say that these substances are Schedule I, and part of my intention in writing the book is to refute that scheduling and hopefully start to be, you know, there is a big conversation to change some of the drug scheduling. I mean, they're still talking about it with marijuana, because they're, you know, it's preposterous to talk about ayahuasca and say that there's a high potential for psychological or physical dependence.
Oh God. Yes.
You know, it's like, nobody would do that. I mean, I have to really gird myself up to go and take that medicine. It's very challenging to take. And
yeah.
It's hard to look at yourself. It's hard to see the shadow side of things. And it's extremely hard to let go of the things that you've been carrying. You know, it's part of our ego thing, is that we, you know, our wounds make us who we are, you know? And so to, you know, you have to almost die.
Yeah.
You know,
the most transformational experiences I have had on ayahuasca are the ones where I felt like I was the closest to death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's part of that. It's because even though we're not actually dying, it's like our ego, our way of looking at ourselves and how we define ourselves, which can be through our problems, you know, that has to die in order to have that kind of healing. And
even just the body load aspect of ayahuasca is like, I don't know anyone who would find it a recreational experience to, you know, throw up or, you know, uncontrollable diarrhea or whatever many things that happen to people on ayahuasca. None of that would be interpreted by anyone who had a lick of sanity as a recreational experience, I wouldn't think.
And the same thing goes with peyote, the same thing. I mean, you know, these things are, you know, they are work, you know, and so they also don't have, they also have accepted medical use, which is another area where things are really starting to change. You know, things have been opening up for more research. especially around psilocybin mushrooms and PTSD and different aspects of that. And so, you know, we're starting to see a little bit of light, as you're mm-hmm. saying, mm-hmm. coming through. But really, I don't have the reference in front of me here, but there was one researcher that I was quoting in the blog that was saying that, you know, if we were really to look at that drug scheduling, you know, the thing that would be the highest on the list would be alcohol.
Right.
Yep. And the second thing would be television or screen, would be screen time.
Right.
Because really, it's really extremely true that, you know, computer addiction and screen addiction, it causes the exact same brain change in our brains as an actual substance. It's the same, you know, addiction yeah. is the same, whether it's something you're ingesting or something or a behavior that you're doing. Mm-hmm. So this is, one blogger that I read summed it up this way. She said, drugs that help people work, fight wars, buy stuff, ignore the pointlessness of their consumer lives, or numb the pain of oppression are all fine. Alcohol fits this category. Caffeine, antidepressants, cocaine. Yep. Drugs that make people generous, cause them to abhor violence, or expose the lies behind power and ideology are the dangerous ones. That's why psychedelics are illegal.
Exactly. Yeah. Terrence McKenna said something a number of years ago very similar to that, a quote that I love.
He said, psychedelics are illegal, not because a loving government is concerned that you may jump out of a third-story window. Psychedelics are illegal because they dissolve opinion structures and culturally laid-down models of behavior and information processing. They open you up to the possibility that everything you know is wrong.
Yeah, so I kind of started the blog off by saying, you know, this is just, you know, this is kind of an ignorance that I'm just really devoted to exposing. And, you know, I'm excited that your site exists, you know, your website. I'm excited. There's so many good, you know, references that I've found from starting to do this research. It's very inspiring to know that there's, you know, people who are on this, also on this edge of wanting things to change.
Likewise. Likewise, mm-hmm. It's good to have allies on the fight.
Yes.
So just to sum things up, why don't you tell us again where people can find out more about your book and your blog. And we will obviously link all to that in the program notes. But if you'd like mm-hmm. to tell people where to find you, and if you are interested in maybe having some of our listeners share their stories with you.
Oh, definitely. I'm really interested in any parents, and also to interview children who maybe have had experience with entheogens. I'm so open to talking with them, and of course I would respect everyone's privacy mm-hmm. And keep everyone anonymous that wanted that. My blog is at www.medicinechildren.info. You can also find me a book page, a book in progress page on Facebook at Medicine Children. I have a website that has a link to some different things, like I have a CD and of medicine music and stuff at www.harmonysuhaney.com.
Cool.
My brother made that website for me. And so that's something that if people are interested in learning about that.
Right on.
You know, I've heard from other people who've tried to respond to the blog that they're having trouble leaving comments on there. So if that's the case, please go to the Facebook page and leave me a comment there. And also you could reach me at harmonysue23@gmail.com
cool.
is my email address.
And I'd also like to point out that Harmony also has a GoFundMe page to help fund her research. And we will be donating to that this week. And I just encourage everybody to pitch in a little bit and help with this really cool work.
Oh, thank you. And I've been getting some great support so far. And thanks so much for remembering to say that.
Sure.
And I just want to leave you guys with this quote. I pray to see the day when this country can be open-minded, when the benefits of these medicines can be experienced in safety and with the assurance of freedom in the sovereign choice to alter one's consciousness for greater health and happiness.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Harmony. I appreciate having you on today.
All right. Thank you, Jonathan.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.